Channel 26 of Croton has made the trip to Newark, New Jersey on October 20th, 1984 to visit the Old Time Radio Convention, our ninth annual program. We are very honored today to have as guests Mr. Frank Wilson and Viola Bond, both of Radio Fame. Frank and Viola, we're not going to be very formal, but I would like to ask both of you, how you got involved in acting, and very, very specifically, radio acting, and even more specifically, radio comedy.
Well, you want to go first, Viola? Go ahead.
It's very difficult to be short with this because it's sort of a long thing, but I got involved in the business when I was 5 years old and went into vaudeville and radio specifically. My first radio job was at KHJ, and it was on the children's hour, and I did cartwheels over the air.
Don't ask her why she did cartwheels over the air, because I don't want to know. I've never found out, as a matter of fact, and I don't think I would now.
And from then I went into vaudeville as a little kid, had my own act, went up and down the country. Went into band singing, and band singing led into the radio station, KNTR, KFWB, and from that into real radio. I think my first job was the Big Town, Edward G. Robinson, and then the Joey Brown Show, and from there on it was just absolute greedy.
Well, actually, I started when I was very young. I was living in Denver, Colorado, and doing amateur theatricals and doing occasional things down at the Denim, which was a stock company at the time. And I was still in high school, and somebody told me that KOA was doing an audition for some kind of a series, and why don't I go out? So I went out to KOA and walked in, and the program director looked up and he said, "What are you here for?" And I said, "Well, they told me you were having an audition." He said, No. He said, this is about a 35-year-old man married to about a 30-year-old girl, and it's a story about this couple, and it ran for 26 weeks for a bank in Denver. And I said, "Oh, well, thank you," and I started to leave. And he said, "Well, wait a minute, have you ever read on a microphone?" And I said, "No, I hadn't." He said, "Well, you know, you've made a long trip out here to the edge of town, maybe you'd like to stay and read." I said, "Well, sure. So I stayed, and there were about 30 of us, and we read. And the next day they called back 12, next day they called back 4, next day they called back and told me I had it. And I played the 35-year-old man with the most beautiful 32-year-old redhead you ever saw in your life. And if I had any brains, knowing what I know today, I might have enjoyed myself more. But I did the best I could with it." So that was really my start, and after that I came out to Hollywood, and I went from that into announcing, from being dramatic into announcing, then back into the dramatic again.
You were on Entertainment Tonight a few nights ago, and your trademark, probably the most famous line that certainly is associated with Jack Benny and Frank Nelson, was "You were slowly turning around, and could you do it for the fans in Croton?"
"Yes! Well, how are you?" Yes, I'll tell you how I got into comedy, because you did ask that up front, and I kind of missed it in my answer. I was basically a leading man, and I was working opposite stars, getting $25, and they were getting $3,500, and I was good enough to work opposite them, but not good enough to get any money, and not even good enough to get credit, because they wouldn't give us any credit in those early days. Nobody knew who did anything. And then dawned on me that I could make a lot more money if I could do comedy and do it well and deliver on it. You could make about 4 or 5 times as much as you could as a leading man. And that's really what led me into it. It's greed, sheer greed. So I started doing comedy, and of course in radio, you could do anything that you could do vocally. That was a great joy for an actor. Every day was a brand new day, because there were no reruns for the 27th time, as you see today in television, and everything was fresh every day, and you could do whatever you were capable of doing vocally. Didn't make any difference whether you were short, tall, fat, thin, old, or young. And so that made a great joy out of it, and I continued to do dramatic parts even after I started comedy, until we got into television. Then, of course, I was trapped by the Jack Benny character, and really, everything I've done in television has been some kind of an offshoot. It may be a gentler approach to it, but it's always, and once in a while, just for fun, I go in and I'll start reading quite straight, you know. They said, well, what we had in mind was, I said, yeah, I know exactly what you had in mind. And we had not gone to Benny character anyway.
We've been on the radio for years. Before you were on the Benny program, could you tell me how you were selected for Benny's show and what it was like working with the cast of the Jack Benny program? Also, how did the shift from radio to TV affect the cast, Benny, and the entire production?
Well, the way I got on the Benny show, I had worked for John Swallow at KFAC, KFED in Los Angeles, and John became the head of NBC. Now, NBC didn't even have a building in Hollywood at that time because all of the major shows emanated from Chicago and New York, and they had not yet decided that there was enough in Hollywood to reverse the lines, which was very expensive, and run shows from west to east. Jack came out to California to do a picture. And, of course, he was doing his show in New York, and they wanted to keep him alive on that show. And so we did a five-minute insert, and John called me to do it. And what it was, we were on a train and coming out to the West Coast, and Jack, of course, is bragging about the fact that he's going to Hollywood, and he's going to be a big star in pictures and so on. And my character, I'm very noncommittal, but very polite to him and so on. And it finally ends up, the sketch ends up, Jack says, well, you know, you seem like a very personable young man. He says, quite possibly I can do something for you out there. My name is Jack Benny. What is your name? And my answer was Clark Gable. And that was the joke. So the following week we did another five-minute insert. Then Jack went back east, and after a period, I don't remember how many months, he brought his show to the West Coast. And I started doing just casual things with him, you know, just parts.
Where can we, aren't you the voice of the famous train conductor?
No.
Was that Mel Blanc?
No.
I'm sorry. Okay.
No. Yeah. Mel Blanc. Anaheim was interesting.
Come on.
What happened, the way this character developed, as I say, I was just doing casual characters for him. And then one day the writer said, hey, we're going to try that again. And I said, try what again? And they said, well, you remember last week you stretched the yes and it got a big laugh? And I cut back, I said, oh, well, yeah, I don't know why I did it, I just happened to do it. And so then they started writing it in, and then we went from there to the ooh and so on. And the first time we did the ooh was funny. Jack had a line, you really hate me, don't you? And so in rehearsal, I said, ooh, do I? And just left it like that, you know. Well, when we got the show, and Jack said, you really hate me, don't you? And I said, ooh.
Oh,
God!
Right on the
foot.
Just absolutely broke
it up. And we knew we were going to do it. The writers knew it. Jack didn't know it until we got through it. And then we got in and, you know, I did well. Like, he did well. You know, I did well. So we just kept ignoring him. You asked what it was like working with the people. And in radio, everybody knew the characters. Everybody was a family to them. As soon as he said, oh, mister, they knew I was coming on. They'd hear, they said, oh, there's Mr. Kitzel. Hello, stranger, there's Sam Hart. Sam Hearn. And so everybody, and then Buck Benny, you remember, we just had an easy cast. They worked well together. Jack knew exactly what he was going to get from everybody, so there was really no direction on the show. Theoretically, you would figure there was, but there wasn't. You'd sit around the table like on Thursday and read the show, and then they'd do any rewrites they wanted to do, and you'd come in on Sunday, read it once, go on mic, do a dress, and do the show.
Were members of the cast of a program like that socially friendly? I know some of them are not with us any longer. Rochester is gone, and of course Jack and Mary. But Phil Harris is here, and there are probably several others.
Yes.
Dennis Day.
Yes.
Do the folks who work together, have they after the show stayed as friends? Or
we're friends? Well, we're friends. friends, but I mean, socially, you know, Los Angeles is real spread out. And I go to see my daughter. That's a 60-mile round trip, and she's, you know, in the Los Angeles area. It's I go to see my son. That's an 80-mile round trip. Actually, I never socialized, I believe, with any of the people on the show. That is, socially, and you know, unless Jack had some kind of a big affair or something like that. Now, Jack and Mel socialized. They were very close friends. Outside of that, I don't know, but all the rest of them we just met because you're running from show to show. In the radio days, we were doing 6 or 7 shows a day, and you simply didn't have the time to do that, nor were you close enough together. Some of the people were 50 miles apart, and yet they worked the show together.
No musicians on radio. How about television? Many of the programs are still being broadcast on CBN and other networks. Are you enjoying some of those residuals?
That's another story, because I intend to get into that and try to find out who's getting the money for that, because we are not getting it. I'm sure that somebody is being paid. I don't think those shows are on there for nothing, and they're supposed to be paid, but simply not. It's like old-time radio. You see, there was no rebroadcast rights for old-time radio. When you get a radio script, if they repeated that script for any reason, and the only reason that they would repeat a radio script ever was because somebody in the cast was ill, and they had a recording of it, and so they'd repeat one from several weeks before because they simply couldn't do a live one that week. Outside of that, you never heard a repeat in radio. They had no rights to do that. They had to negotiate or pay the full original fee in radio. Yet, you hear countless radio shows today. Of course, on some of them, the copyrights have run out, and therefore there's no claim by anybody. But the real thing is that you can never find out where they were released, who did it, how did they get there. Usually, it's because somebody recorded it maybe for themselves, gave it to a friend to a disc jockey somewhere, gave it to him, and he said, hey, that's great, I'll put it on the show. Next thing you know, it's all over.
Jack Benny's programs, many of them come from Jack Benny's personal collection. I'm told that he is one of the most generous people in terms of being willing to share his own programs. While he was still alive, he would permit people to visit him and to record some of his programs. And they're available back to the 1930s. I have some Jack Benny programs in my collection that were done his first or second year on the air, 1933 and 1934, and all the way through 38 and 39, and the sound quality on some of them are terrific. I'm going to be criticized by our director if I don't give Viola an opportunity to do it.
Viola. Yes.
Viola.
Oh, okay. So Eddie Cantor always used to call me Viola. Nobody called me Viola. I changed the spelling 3 times, and it was still Viola. So I've given up.
Were you a steady...
I had an enviable place in that golden time because I looked lovely, my body was lovely, it had an audience, and I slithered and whittled across the stage and get at the mic just in time to say the line, and everybody fell apart because I was dressed. We dressed for women, dressed for the audience. There were about 250-300 people in the audience. And as soon as they saw me approaching, it was starting to go, and it began to build, and then I would go up and say, hello, do you mind? And Jack said, what did he say, dear?
I always dream about her.
Yeah, I did, on the Benny Show, I did Spanish, French, I did Southern, and when Mary was not feeling well, I would stand by. They'd redo the script and I would do it. And on all of the other shows, as I started to say, I was a femme fatale foil. Bergen and McCarthy, I sang with Dick Powell on the Bergen Show. I sang with Crosby. I did a lot of singing and acting too. And it was just a very thrilling part of my life.
What about Eddie Camper?
Eddie Camper! Oh, yes, the Eddie Camper Show. Yes, Eddie was wonderful. I won an audition and got on the show, and here Deanna Durbin, Pinky Tomlin, Jack Renard, his orchestra, and of course the Mad Russians. And we did Bert Gordon, yes. And we did shows, so we took the show to New York. We even performed in, I think, two convention halls at that time, Cleveland and the Philadelphia Hall. Each was 12,000 people, and they were stacked. Tears all over. It was very thrilling.
Excuse me, you know, the kid, I don't know, she doesn't know even enough to tell you that what she did was Mademoiselle Pepe.
Oh.
Oh, good Lord.
Oh, well, I just assumed.
Yes.
Tell us about Mademoiselle. I just told you about Mademoiselle
Pepe. No,
That's it.
That's what you hired her for, don't put her on the tongue cut.
Yes, it was a French. French was always my love. But I did the Spanish ones. I sang with Gildersleeve. I was Gildersleeve's Spanish girlfriend, and we sang Besame Mucho, you know, together.
Which one was Rose Warden or the Carol Perry?
I was on the boat. Both, yes.
You know the story about those two? Carol Perry and Willard Waterman were both Chicago radio actors. Long before Great Gildersleeve, they were just actors like we all were. You went in, you did X number of shows, and you did different characters. They both did that character as one of the things that they did on local Chicago shows. Whoever got there first, if they happened to think that character would play, would be the character. So when Hal Perry quit the show, Lord Waterman walked right in and nobody knew that Hal had left. That's one of those things where Willard didn't come in and do an imitation of Hal Perry. He just did the character that they had both done in all their Chicago days, which is different than you know, you'd think, well, if he just came in and did an imitation, that is very nice. But he didn't. He was really doing what he had done when he was just an actor in Chicago.
Not only do I get to hear old radio programs in my collection, but organizations like Spurtback and others, people like yourselves and Hal Perry and Willard Waterman get to hear the stories of their lives. And I think it was Hal Perry who wanted to buy the program or piece of the program from Kraft. They weren't willing to sell it to him, and he thought that by leaving, he would perhaps make a better deal. But obviously, as you pointed out, it didn't work out. But he also could do a drama. He worked with Art Oba. In some of the Lights Out programs, there's a very, very fine one where he plays a dentist who's getting even with a man who's made love to his wife. Imagine being in a dental chair. One of those circumstances.
Tell you an Arch Obler story. I got a call from Arch one week to do the lead opposite Helen Mack. And so I went down, and Helen Mack had a speech about this long. And then I said, oh. And then she had one about this long. And I said, oh. Then she had one about this long. And I said, And this is the way it went through the script. So the following week, I'm doing Lux Radio. And there was an actor on the West Coast, Lou Merrill, did an awful lot of work. And Lou was on the show. And they each called us the Gold Dust Twins, because we were both of us running from show to show all the time. So Lou says, hey, I'm on Oprah this week. I said, oh, what are you seeing? Tell him that the floor that ad-libbed opposite Helen Mack last week said hello. He gave him a message, and I didn't work for Arch for 2 years. He got so mad about it.
I reminded him of it when we were doing something to honor Lorraine Tuttle out there at an affair, and I said, you remember Arch? And well, he got mad. He didn't think that was funny at all.
He was probably the only person in the field of old radio who does challenge people today who are replaying his broadcast. He is well known for that. Most other radio personalities, I think, are honored and enjoy the fact that that collectors and some of the nonprofit stations are playing these shows. But Oprah, I understand, goes after them with a passion.
Yeah, he does. And there's one reason that he keeps copyright on everything, and he challenges anybody to use it. But he doesn't know, and he's not going to see this program, so I'm going to tell you. About 76, wasn't it? We were asked to go to Washington, D.C., and to appear for the Smithsonian on the Mall about working Americans, was the title, I think, of the whole thing. And we were to do something about radio. So when we got there, I said, well, what is it you want us to do? And they said, oh, what do you want to do? And I said, oh, good Lord, I thought you had material for us. You had things that you wanted. Oh, no, whatever you'd like to do. I said, well, what do you have in the radio tent? And they said, well, we have a newsman, and we have a sound man, and we have a sportscaster and engineer. And so we thought, and I said, I got an idea. We can find some material. Let's show them what was taken away from them, something that they no longer have, comedy and drama in radio, because it just doesn't exist anymore. Now, if we can just get some material. So we start running around Washington. Where are you going to find scripts, you know? Who are you going to go to? What was the name of it? It's old-time radio, but it's a library of old-time radio.
Yes,
there. So we started thumbing through things.
I
and
to tell about this lovely lady who helped us, Catherine
Hines. Yes. So anyway, we started going through this material. We found an old thing from the 30s of an old Midwest couple sitting on the porch rocking. No, honey, I mean, I want to do a little bit. In the first place, you don't know the lines, neither do I. What are you talking about? Sure you do. So anyway, she's not going to let me tell the story, is she? She's going to keep interrupting. Boy. So anyway, we picked that, and then we picked another thing, which was Arches. It was a cute little sketch. And it's a young man on his way to his wedding. And you think, of course, that the girl is his fiancée. Uh-uh. The girl, this one, is a baby abandoned in the back seat. And they got the baby cries, and he stops on the way and makes a phone call, and an old man lets him in, and I doubled that. And then he says, you know my children? Just, oh, that's wonderful.
Because we've already got a baby.
And that's the end of it. Yeah. And she's doing the baby cries in the back seat. So anyway, we did that, and then we reminisced and told stories, and we told about things that had happened that you couldn't get back, you know, where something went out over the air, and there was no way to get it back again. Yeah, real bloopers, I mean, some of those in radio.
Do you share a few bloopers with us, Greg?
Well, let's see. We did that. Setting fire to the script, everybody did that. You know, the newsman's working. He's come in and light the thing, and he's trying to get it out. He can't. And, we did a lot of those bad things. But talking about actual bloopers on the air, we had a very dramatic show out there called Witch's Tales. And, Old Man City. Oh, you know it. Alonzo Dean Cole. So anyway, I was the leading man on Witch's Tales, and I came to the end of this first act, a highly dramatic scene, and my line was, you killed my boy. And I started to say son, and I tried to change back, and what came out was, you killed my soy! And I'm dying. And Lindsay McCarry was the director, and he sent a note out to me, and just as we were going to start the second act, I flipped this thing open and looked at it, and he says, my little soy, how have you been? And I thought, oh, no, I'm not going on at all. I tell you, those things kill you. And you catch somebody's eye, you know, somebody breaks up, and you catch their eye, you're dead. I've seen things where the whole show is dissolved. Everybody's going, ah! And everybody says, what's going on? What is that? Mel Blanc had one day I forgot who the announcer was. Oh, Ken Miles. And Ken had a very high-pitched laugh. And Ken was reading something about Pepsi, and all of a sudden he goes, excuse me. Pepsi is, and he goes again. And he says, Mel, take it. And Mel picked it up and just read it. From that night, he never looked at it. He just read it because Ken couldn't do it. He was through. He was finished. And, Dr. Christian.
Rosemary?
Yes, I know, but his name! Oh, Gene Herschel. All of a sudden I can't. I don't know why I can't think of Gene, but I couldn't think of his name. Yes, that's right. Gene Herschel, when you did that, there were people who really thought he was Dr. Christian, you know. They almost revered the man. And when you did his show, it was kind of like being in church. And Art Gilmore was the announcer, a very lovely man, and very well-trained, gentlemanly type, and he would talk to the audience, and they all just sat there enthralled by Gene and so on. Well, Gene worked in a spotlight, and Rosemary DeCamp worked in a spotlight. That's, you got two spotlights on the stage, and that's all the light. Now, this week, Rod O'Connor, who we called the dirty old man of radio, he was an announcer, and he weighed about 300 pounds, and could tell you more dirty stories in 30 minutes than you could possibly assimilate. And so Rod is replacing because Art's on vacation. And he goes out, makes the speech, and does a nice job of that. And now Gene gets to a line, and his line is, there was Judy peeking through the keyhole. And what? And then he continues the line, because Rosemary can't talk until he ends the line, because the balance of the line is what she responds to. So Gene says, and there was Judy peeing through the keyhole. Now, there is a pause that you wouldn't believe, and Rosemary is sitting there frozen in her spotlight, and Gene is looking at his script and going, I mean, you can see it all going through his mind. Couldn't possibly have done that. And the audience doesn't make a sound. Now, had there been any other audience except for Gene Herschel, they would have yelled. But Dr. Christian, no. So it's dead silence. Now, the funniest part of the whole thing is over here at the side of the stage, behind the curtain, is Rod O'Connor. And he is jumping from one foot to the other and cramming the drinks into his mouth to keep from bursting out laughing. And finally, after about a 10-second pause, Gene went on with the line, and Rosemary was able to pick up the script. And I'll never forget that as long as I live. It was Judy Gene through the keyhole. Now, I don't know if one of you use that on cable, but there it is.
We have a very little connection. I'm trying to wrap this up by asking you both two more questions, and then we will probably give you a chance to share your personality with the rest of the folks who attend this convention. If you can tell us perhaps some of your favorite people to work with, other than Jack Benny and perhaps Eddie Cantor, people that the folks back home would remember, and what are you folks doing today? Commercials or voiceovers? How are you enjoying life in the 1980s?
Well, I'm still doing commercials. I just did some the other day for Detroit, which was strictly the Benny character. Of course, I did a campaign about a year back for McDonald's, where I was the spokesman for them. And I've been doing cartoon series for Hanna-Barbera. I did a series a couple of years ago called Dinky Dog, and then last year I did one called Monchichis, and in which I was the wizard, or the wizard, as they called him. And I did Dinky Dog. I was the uncle of the two girls, and of course the foil for the dog in Dinky Dog is a huge dog. And we have just gone on the air with a show called The Snorks. The reason they're called Snorks is because we have little snorkels because we live under the sea, and I am the governor of Snorkland. So I do those kind of things if they find me. They have to hunt for me because I'm not really looking for anything. And of course, Mama's home working over a hot stove, so don't let her get out very much. You know, keep her home, keep her locked up in the closet.
Well, favorite people is very difficult, but I would say, naturally, Benny, of course, as you said. But Bing Crosby, Bob Hope, I loved Abbott and Costello. I worked in movies with them. Oh, golly, there's so many. I have to end it there because I can't think of anything.
Who worked with Benny first?
Oh, sure.
Well, yes.
She is a character that I... Baby Smith's character, I think so many of us remember and love. Can you tell us about what Benny was really like to work with?
Well, I don't know whether you knew. Hanley Stafford was Daddy.
Yes.
My first husband.
I did not know.
Yeah. So I was very, very close to them. And I loved the show, too. You know, oh, Blondie, of course. Blondie, but Hanley was Mr. Dithers. And this one here, my now husband,
Herb
Woodley. Yes.
I am learning a great deal.
Yes. So it's very difficult to Well, we worked with all of the people during the war. You know, went on Navy bomb drives into March Field and these big planes, and it was a very exciting period.
Well, talk about Fanny Bryce having trouble getting away from the Baby Smith's character. Is that just legend, or is that...
Getting away.
That sometimes when she was off the air, she would still play... Or still pretend to be that...
No, Fanny was a realist. Oh, no, no, no. She was a very admixture of elegance and gutter. She really was. She came from the Lower East Side. And when she would go to the dressing room, she would lie down and belch a lot. I mean, she really did. Yeah, it was just, she was just herself. When we bought our home, Fanny decorated our home, and she got up into the area where we were, and we have a beautiful view of the city, and she says, "Oh my God, kid, look, I've got goosebumps. Look at the view," and she pulled her skirt up. And just, she was just basic. She came to the house, she cooked potato pancakes when we had only a stove in the house. She was a wonderful woman. She was just pure herself. She knew from Aldous Huxley to Polly Moran, who used to take her teeth out and regale everybody with something like that. No, she had to, and Bea Lilly, of course, was one of her best friends. And Hanley and Fanny did not really socialize, just occasionally. He felt it best to keep the two apart.
I was
Nadia, Princess Nadia in Fu Manchu. And
Chandu,
I beg your pardon. Chandu the magician, that's right.
Oh, that's right.
Yes.
In Cortland, who was a Chandu fan. He has hours and hours of Chandu.
Yes. Well, this was the area when the period when Tom Collins did the jewel, and I was Princess Naji. Yes.
Frank and Viola.
Thank you.
This has been my moment of moments. I really have had a terrific time meeting you. You are the most gracious couple that we have had the experience of having at our convention. I hope that the folks in Croton who have an opportunity to watch this tape are as thrilled with the experience as I have been, but I don't know that there are as many radio nuts as I am. There are, I'm happy to say, not hundreds but thousands of people who still not just remember but listen to and enjoy your talents.
I'm going to kiss you.
Thank you.
Well, that about wraps it up. I hope you have enjoyed this small portion of the convention which I could share with you. Thanks for tuning in.